This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are on remote with David Keplinger, poet, translator, teacher, I say philosopher. He'll read from his latest book, The World to Come. And here is David.
Angels and Wounds. A play called Angels and Wounds by David Keplinger that goes on for years and has no curtain, where the author plays one of the parts. In some scenes, it's the wound in him that sees the same wound in the other. What's reenacted is an old disaster. In some scenes, it's his angel that addresses the other's wound, or it's reversed and he's the wounded one drawn to the angel. Codependence casts its green light on the stage. There's hardly any dialogue except the sound of silverware, bottle caps, slamming doors. But in some scenes, the angel in him engages the angel in the other. Mm-hmm. It's the same play his parents put on, and he plagiarized everything.
That last line is what I wanted to start with. David Keplinger, The World to Come. Why is that book entitled something we can't imagine?
Well, it depends on how you think about the world to come. I try to imagine it from a few different angles. It's a great opening question.
Well, what is in this book that isn't in other books, or what is in this book that are in your other books?
Well, but to go back a step, the world to come that I'm trying to imagine is the one that we're born into, which is the body. So for the first half of this collection of prose poems, the speaker is gathering the metals of the spheres in order to make himself a body. And then in the second half, the world to come is the loss of the body, the diminishment of the body, and the disappearance of the body. And that's the eventual invisibility. And that's a kind of world to come as well.
Oh, wow. That is why I call you a philosopher. Because however you take all the proofs and turn them upside down, and yet you come out with the right answer, your logic is imagined, and it is metrics that were never known before, but it all comes out right. So give us another poem and we'll tell you what you're doing.
Okay, this poem is called Sassaferrato. It's from the first half of the book, Sassaferrato. And you might know the painter Sassaferrato. There's a beautiful image of the Madonna with an ultramarine that's just unforgettable. And that's what I'm referring to here. In Sassaferrato, it's the ultramarine that holds the idea of Mary, looking down at her hands, that captures the spirit of her prayer. It's a painting about the sea in love with the mountain crest, just as the mountain crest grasps how it will never know itself like the sea knows it. The sea at Carmel was similar. It surrounded the glass windows, and at night I heard colors like a musician does. My mother was dying. She was more pain than body then. And when the body receded, and then the pain, just after, slowly, what was left was pure crystal, blue salt. It was Sassaferrato who associated this color with the mother, the force of love that cradles and crashes over the thing until it is the thing.
Once again, repeat who Sassaferrato was.
Sassaferrato was a painter of the Italian Renaissance, and the colors in Sassaferrato are just unforgettable. They're so crystalline. And for me, the idea of Mary and the spirit of her prayer is carried over, or are carried over, in those colors. They kind of precede the picture or the story of Mary. There's a feeling that you get that comes from the color itself, like a musician seeing colors.
How did the color suggest the dying of your mother and her fragility and her vaporizing? Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
You know, it happens instantaneously in the writing of the poem. Suddenly I'm in Carmel, and then suddenly the sea and the mountain crest, and then there's my dying mother. But I think that there's a line in there that says, the sea knows the mountain crest like the mountain crest will never know it. And there is something to be said about the mother knowing the child in a way that the child will never know himself. And then the mother crashes over the child and disappears. And there's an essence of her that's left in the speaker, in me. I mean, these poems are, of course, imagined fables, but they're all about me. They're all about
me. You know, the self is a very interesting theme in your work, how you regard the self, because it is just a concept that really wasn't with us until the 16th century, but it permeates your work in a very subtle way. And we're going to be picking up on that more. Now, these poems are prose poems. They have a shape like a paragraph. And you said that putting things in that shape focuses you. Talk a little bit about how form gets you to where you want to be.
Well, it's the old question of the chicken and the egg. What comes first, the form or the content of the poem? And for me, it's always been imagining a space. I was talking to my students about this very thing two nights ago, where I was asking them to remember how it feels to write one of their best poems. How it felt for me every time I wrote a successful poem, at least in this book, was that first there appeared a shape, and then there came to me an understanding that all I had to do was fill that shape up with words. And the box for me is a very potent instigator of that experience. James Joyce said that in silence, cunning, and exile, we come to our art. And the cunning part is to me, and this comes from Joseph Campbell, the cunning part for me is about repeating that experience of apprehending the content via the form over and over again. So I like to think in form first, and then I fill the form up as the content comes to me.
First the shape, and then all you have to do is fill it up. No problem.
Hundreds of times you get it wrong, but that one time when you get it right, it really does feel that way.
I think we can do it. Somehow there seems to be a magic wand there that somehow we could do that. You've entitled us to that. So you have chosen this form for this book, and are you happy with it?
I am. Well, I tried different forms for this book. I wrote them as paragraphs. Some of them were just one sentence long, and having that box shape and the relative length already established, it gave me a sense of, you know, how to complete the poem and how big it was going to be even before I began it. And that's helpful. It's like writing sonnets.
We're waiting for your book of essays.
I've been working on it for a long time.
All you have to do is go back into all your interviews and just have someone transcribe them, because you do talk about process a lot, and you have things that were never said really before. So I'm thinking that's in your future. So let us read two together, and then we'll get a good sense of you, and then we'll be happy.
Wonderful. Okay, this is the opening poem in the book. This is a very short one, and then I'll read a poem called Fox. This is called Premise. That your shoes are two fish, a school that moves by the singular will. That the body is here, but elsewhere too. That there exists a body of wind, one for you, one for the city, the country, the planet. That there's one wind moving all of this just so. Even the bride in the white wedding gown, and the groom in the charcoal suit, the beautiful car that's waiting for them, the vast night.
Oh, the expectation, how you leave it without a falling. I just, before your next poem, I just want them to know that you are the winner of the Rilke UNT Prize, the St. Louis Literary Award, the Kafafi Prize, the T.S. Eliot Prize, the Colorado Book Award, the Erskine Price Award, the Emily Dickinson. Let's hear a poem.
Grace, your the strength of your mudita is very great.
Well, our lists are beautiful things. And this is a long list.
Well, I thank you. This is called Fox. I count my blessings like a fox does. I skulk like the stoles of my grandmother. In Harleysville on High Street, deep in my Catholic years, her stoles lay silent on the beds at parties in the houses she said were too rich for her. I'm the slow reader who must say the words out loud. I hold every word in my mouth like an egg. I come from the guild of the thieves. I loathe and long for what won't have me, the way my grandmother threw the fox head wide-eyed over her shoulder as she left in a huff.
Now, that's very interesting. Listening to those two poems together, I can tell how alone you had to get to be in that first poem. I know, I can feel that there is no amount of loneliness too great to enter to get to that first poem. And this poem was not written in that state of being whatsoever. It was a very declarative, very, it's complex, it's narrative, but there's a tone about your work that I can tell that you get into a place on the verge of arid. It is so lonely. And it's so, funny. Where else does this stuff come from? Where else could this stuff possibly come from?
Well, you know, there's the box that we talked about formally speaking, but there's also for me the sentence. That's why I love writing prose poems, because even though the lines can do things that a sentence cannot, lines can make a phrase mean twice by the way that it carries over into the next line and by the way it stands as a unit by itself. So lines are powerful and I use them all the time. But in the sentence, when it's just plain bare bones, the sentence, there is that aridness that you're talking about. And we all have our desert poems, and we all have our paradiso poems, and we all have our hell poems. You know, for me, the desert is the equivalent of purgatory. Poems stuck in a time state of waiting. So I agree with you. I think that there is a loneliness and exile poem in me that I come back to again and again.
And it works for you. So I would take out the word dry. I do not mean that whatsoever. Yours are just full, rich. They're vibrant. But there is a place you go that nobody has the patience to go. And there, you know that's true, don't you?
Well, I don't think of it that way, but I appreciate the blessing.
Well, you know, someone perhaps...
I count my blessing like a fox does.
But, you know, sometimes someone can experience you. And that's the magic, that I can experience where you are when you write these things. So let's have more, please. More, please.
Okay, this is connected to the previous poem. It's called The Iron Age. Often three at a time, the hat pins held the pillbox hat to the hair, attached to the brim by an Iron Age design. The head is a teardrop of pearl, and the woman, with a face that recalled the paintings of Sargent, would sit at those circular tables in another century, along with her three small daughters, who would sometimes receive on the lower part of the thigh, just below the hem of the skirt, the quick jab, its drop of blood as perfect and round as a burial mound.
Your knowledge of art and history and literature really help a lot, don't they? But then you don't take them at face value. You turn them on edge and you get something entirely different from what the original meant. What did you do to that painting to make it, to enchant it to something else?
Well, the image is of my grandmother. It's of the same person with the fox stall in the previous poem. And my grandmother had the look of someone of another century. In fact, there is it's a very eerie thing for me. There is a painting from a sarcophagus made in Egypt by Italians who lived there in the year 0 to 100. They were officers and they were people who were sent, diplomats sent to Egypt to serve Rome. And they died there. And then when they were buried in these cartonnages, their images were painted on the front of the cartonnage. And they lasted. They're all over the world. You can find them in Australia and you can find them in Berlin. And in fact, on my last sabbatical, I found them in various places all around the world and wrote poems about them. But there's one in particular that is my grandmother. It's her face. It's a face from the 19th century, but it's also a face from the year zero. There's something about her because she was born in 1910 to parents who had, you know, come from Sicily, which was more like the 18th century at that time. That makes her for me a figure who is very old and like a kind of goddess figure that represents a lost time. So by focusing on her and thinking about Sargent or thinking about those images from Egypt, I get into a place that's, you know, 2000 years old, the Iron Age, thinking about that little pin that she used to jab her daughters to keep them behaving in church, which is a terrible story that my mother told me. But I guess at the time it was perfectly appropriate. And I don't know how often they got jabbed. Maybe it was just the threat of being jabbed.
It's an
image that never haunted me forever until I could write the poem.
Well, that's what's left out, which works so well, because first of all, I thought it was an actual portrait, 19th century. I mean, we've seen those portraits of mothers with the children around the table, mm-hmm. and it seems so perfectly right. And then the ending, which upends logic, you know, we don't know the reason for it. It feels so right, but we take it as, I took it as complete authenticity. Now look at all these layers that are on this poem that aren't really there, but are essential to make.
Well, that's one of the things, Grace, as you know, it's the things that we leave out and that we trust the reader will apprehend, will find on their own, in their own way, that don't need to be in the poem, that is really the work of a poet after, decades of doing this. I have learned to trust that there will still be a trace of that essence there in the poem, even though I haven't written it. It's kind of a weird thing that my grandmother, for me, is very much in that poem. And I know that what's behind my grandmother, which is that sense of history and that sense of the ache of a human's impression on the world in the form of a droplet of blood that becomes a burial mound, is there without my having to say, here's how I made this poem. I started thinking about my grandmother and then those images from Egypt and then how she appears also in Sargent and she's this eternal figure who's like a god. I left all of that out and just focused on the hat pin and
exactly
how it's all there by the language that I use. I mean, it's not all there. Of course, that would be assuming too much, but it's a matter of trust. It's saying, you know, this is a poem that is as much a co-creation between me and you as it is me offering some kind of meaning or some kind of message to the reader.
I'm so glad you described that, because that is really the interesting thing, is that it remains formalized with all of that evanescent, all of that trust, all of that invisible stuff going on. We get a very formalized picture, which I think is really interesting. It is a portrait. You wind up with a portrait. I would tell you that poet and translator David Keblinger is the author of five other poetry collections, or there's six more.
This is my seventh book.
That's right, because we have the new one
selected. Yeah.
The Most Natural Thing, The Prayers of Others, The Clearing, The Rose Inside, Another City, then The Long Answer, which was new and selected, and now this, this book, which is entitled what?
This book, The World to Come?
Right. The World to Come. And his poetry has been the biggest and the best of all of our periodicals. And he has been renowned, really, for translating, which we'll get to that also. Fellowships from NEA and the Soros Foundation, Pennsylvania Council, DC Council. Have you moved to different states just to get grants? Go ahead, do it.
I have moved around a lot, and people have been very nice to me.
Good move.
This is all what you're reading is all over a period of 30 years. I mean, I entered my MFA program in 1991. So this is a lot of years of sending out applications and things like that. It's lovely to hear, but spread out over those years, it's just a matter of one poem at a time, sending
that's
them around.
Your modesty. We will not accept your modesty. This is well-earned. This is distinguished material. This is work. This is work. The Cacafé Prize from Poetry International, the Erskine Poetry Prize from Smartish Place. I mean, no disclaimers are allowed because you are a working poet. You work every day in addition to teaching students, five days a week now. But truly, if anyone has made the commitment and the declaration that this is a life force, it's on the page. And we want another poem to prove it. David Keplinger is here, and I'm high.
Okay, this is we're still in The World to Come. And this is the last poem of the book. It's also part of a series. Well, let's do two, if you don't mind. They're short.
I need them, yes. They're very short.
This first one, yeah. And just for the sake of those who are seeing it on YouTube, these are what they all look like. So this first one is called Truce. The cinema that rainy day was warm and dry. Its film was silent. A horse was racing with a Model T among our stiff black coats and hats. The car puffed smoke. The white horse snorted. Then the film stopped. The crouching horseman had fallen half out of frame. Only in stillness like that, my friends, will God and devil call their truce. Then it started up again, as if letting out a breath. And this is the final poem of the book. It's called The Third Person. One must speak of the eternal self in the third person only. The eternal self stood beneath the olive trees that wagged their branches. It lived off sunlight once and the gloppy impasto of rain. The internal self once had hands and a face, eyes and a mouth. But snails ate up the grass, then the sky, the sun, until there was no world, no light, the body invisible. All that remained were birds who knew how to fly at night, and snails and insects, instead of words that speak of an eternal self, instead of the work of the hands.
Instead of a work of the hands, you know, said once, we belong to others' lives. You said once that things witness us. You have a very complex view of self. And what do you think? Are you aware of how many ramifications you use from the self, which I find to be a very interesting thing? I mean, we didn't even know it until the end of the 16th century, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, self. Okay, what is self?
Unless you talk about the Buddha, which is 2,500 years ago.
No, that we're going to go. I think that's your next book, of course. I think
we have that, and see, that's why this conversation with you for me is so fruitful, because in you, I see someone who is looking in the places that I also find interesting,
and This is very, this is, I, that is why I love you. It's all about me. I knew that. Well, back to yourself, you know, this is a reclaiming of it. Everything you're doing is a reclaiming of self. And so talk about self as you knew it. I mean, did it start when Christianity came and we knew that we could sin? And then all of a sudden, I mean, you are always looking at the self in a mirror that keeps changing. Mm. Tell me what you know about what you're doing.
Oh boy, that is a question. I love the line from Joseph Brodsky, which I use in an essay, in an unpublished essay recently, that consciousness began with the first lie.
Oh, and that's perfect.
That our awareness of ourselves came in the feeling that we were separate from others and that we had to protect ourselves from them.
But he took that from the Reformation, because that's when people started looking at themselves in sin.
That's right.
Christianity. That's right. But so you have you, but you see yourself as not a solid being.
Right. Well, that's what are we talking about when we talk about self? If we're talking about self the way Whitman talks about self, then that Brodsky statement doesn't apply. But if we're talking about ourselves as separate beings, David Keplinger, a play about David Keplinger plagiarizing everything from his parents, then that sense of there are secrets that I keep to myself, that I can't stand myself, that I need to protect myself. Those kinds of statements are yes. all about creating walls that indicate a space that isn't safe in the world.
Exactly. Those enclosures. But then you
see. But to me, the self, the grand self of Whitman is very safe, because behind it is love. I mean, that's my belief. And it's something that has turned in my work slowly. It began differently when I was 25, but now something has changed in me that has changed the work too, and changed my concept of the self. That's why in that last poem, the body disappears. So in the beginning of the book, the body with the premise poem, the body appears and it gathers the metals. And that comes from Augustine, from St. Augustine, saying that we pass through the seven spheres in order to gather the metals of our personality. And then we come to earth and here we are, this body. But there's also the casting off of those metals at the end. And what's left is this invisibility, which is the great self that is propelled eternal. By love. Yeah.
Eternal. And but you do something more in each poem. Sometimes the self is seen by others, such as in The Fox. You know, that is a kind of a look at how society is treating us. Sometimes yourself is everyone else. And sometimes it is David Keplinger. You know, it is a poet. The poet's voice is very evident. But I find...
I name myself in this.
I love it. Yeah.
I
think this is your main thrust. I think this is the thing you will be remembered for. And as you proceed into mindfulness and into the areas where you're going, I think we can look at major contributions in this theory, which I don't think is done yet. This theory.
Well, I'm ready, Grace. I believe me, I'm doing that work. I'm a little shy to show it to anybody, mm-hmm. to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. But it's coming, because you are evolutionary, and I'm glad. Let's have another poem.
Shall we move away from this book, or would you like to hear another one?
We could hear one more and then go to another.
Well, since we're on the subject of the self, let's go to a poem called First Person. This is the second poem in the book. So you heard the third person, which is the end of the book. This is the first person. I could hardly stand to be a body before God scrapped me as I was and started over. This happened many times. Once I was much taller, like a walking cliff wall. But the heaviness of having fists and breasts and a penis and knees and a womb and feet with veins like cottonwood roots bore me down. I had to be burned up and begun again. Another time I was very small. I could fit into a tiny hole along the Euphrates. I had to stave off the wolf spider, God's beloved, who questioned me with three eyes. Alone in the world, there was only the river and no one to wash their long hair in it.
Well, that is what you do in every poem. You divest yourself of your humanness, and then you use humanity to fulfill that place, that empty space. So I watch you as a very interesting spiritual spectacle, which is kind of a little specimen that I'm watching, really, because you are evidencing your spiritual growth on the page.
Isn't that the gift of writing our lives, Grace? This is for everyone, whether they publish their poems or not.
Not everyone has spiritual growth.
Don't you think that the writing also provides the seeds that by looking deeply into things, things start looking back at you?
No question. Some people do it better than others. So that's another poem. Some people just do it plain better than others.
Yeah, you can get stuck in that practice and just looking out at things and describing them and saying implicitly in that action, look at me, look at me, look at me.
And
but then something does turn eventually and you say, look at that, look at that.
Well, I think you're right there. I mean, some people make a career out of just observing, you know, and noticing things. But you're saying that if you do it every moment, it is a spiritual practice and something's going to happen to you, whether you like it or not.
I think that if you're doing it and you're just like meditation, if you're doing it with the right intention in mind, then something is going to happen. And if you're not doing it with the right intention, something might happen too. It might fool you into this kind of transformation, which in fact is what happened to me. I got into this because I wanted to be seen and I wanted my ideas to be taken seriously. And I wanted to prove myself in the world. And eventually something shifted. And I have to attribute that as much to teaching as to poetry, because teaching taught me to be happy for the success of others. And that really does bring a lot of, it infuses your work with joy and noticing in a way that it wouldn't be if you weren't doing that teaching aspect as well.
And to be quite bold to say that all that love you give comes back to you. It's a very practical thing, actually, that we get in teaching. But
it really does. You're right.
Mm-hmm. And it's very nourishing, too. Well, let's go on with more poetry.
Okay.
I forgot to tell everyone who you were for a long time. David Keplinger, American University prize-winning author, translator, and a person who has given up fear.
I wish that were true.
Not all of it. We need a little bit so that we won't run out of the street naked like some of the people you've written about. But I do think...
Bless that man.
Mm-hmm. That is great. The trust... that I see, look, who could do what you do? Who takes all logic and turns it upside down? Who takes something together, broken, and ends up together instead of together and ends up broken in a poem? I mean, who turns everything on its head? That is a lack. You can't be afraid and do that. You just can't be afraid and do that.
You know who did that? When you say it like that, it's profound to me. It's my dad. My father was an electrician.
Oh.
He loved fixing broken things. Broken things were more beautiful to him than perfect things. That each one was an encounter with, you know, possibility and a test of his skills to put things back together. So his love of the broken is something that I'm lucky to have inherited.
But you don't say that in your poems about
him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to that yet. I just realized it now.
There's more stuff coming because the father in literature is it.
Hmm.
The father in literature, I don't think we have a program where we don't touch on it. But with you, it's just like almost like at the beginning. Like, I just get the tip of him. I just, now just you saying that, that is pretty awesome. Go ahead, David, give us more.
Okay. Well, here's a poem that features my father and my mother. It's called 222 West 23rd Street, which is the address of the Chelsea Hotel where Bill and Thomas died. But I left that out of the title. It's just 222 West 23rd Street. Rage will have to learn gentleness. It will not be for the light or against it. My father wouldn't leave us when he died, getting up and blowing out our candles, blasting the ballasts of halogen in his former house. He wanted to unset the sun along the trees where it would flatten. My mother, on the other hand, would fight to never look again straight into mirrors and pass the big one in the upper hall many times without acknowledging her eggshell hands, the crumpled hairs, in her attitude that none of this was real, but staged for someone's weird, kind-hearted laughing. So that's a different poem. A rhymed sonnet.
And what book is that in?
This is The Long Answer.
Oh, You're New and Selected.
The New and Selected, yeah.
Oh, so you have how many different forms in that book? That's a little bit like 10 poems from each book?
It's about 160 pages. There are about 15 poems from each book in this, and then there are 30 pages of new poems at the end. And among those new poems, I have a villanelle, I have a few sonnets, I have some pretty tight tercets, and you know, some experiments in some forms. And in my new book, I have guzzles and other things. Those traditional forms or received forms are very fruitful for me, so I use them often. I have two minds. One is Charles Simic writing "The World Doesn't End," and the other one is Seamus Heaney writing his spectacular poems about history and Ireland and forms.
This is so true. This is so true about you, but I think that form is the way you find your freedom, and it's very interesting to see. Let us have another poem.
Okay, so this is a step away from those subjects, and it is a poem that is called "Composition for the Faith of Clifford Brown." Clifford Brown was a great jazz performer of the 1950s, and when he was 25, he died in a car accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And the interesting thing is that he's young, and his name is Clifford Brown, and it kind of reminded me of Hawthorne's Young Goodman Brown. He was also a good man. He in a time when to be a jazz performer meant addiction and the kind of romanticism of that image that drew so many in. By his reputation, according to Sonny Rollins, always stood back from that and, you know, focused on the music. So it's a shame we lost him so young. So this is called "Composition for the Faith of Clifford Brown." On June 25, 1956, it's a hard bop, Max Roach on drums, that brings you up to Philadelphia, it's reported, to Music City, I've heard tell, to serenade a wall of cigarette smoke, stone sober, with tinkling glass and ashtrays falling down slow motion, your second to last night alive. There's much to get wrong about this story. Like any story often riffed, how it was not on the following night your wife, but Richie Powell's, who did the driving and the rain, I once believe was pouring on the empty Pennsylvania Turnpike, was falling instead on a town called New Bedford near Pittsburgh, as your party passed through dead tired. I can't know if you fell in slow motion, asleep in the passenger seat, because you wanted to relax your hands. I can't know if you wanted to lay your head against your Buick's thick window and sleep to the sound of syncopated raindrops spattering in flutes across the glass, or even if you intended, with the faith of 25-year-olds, to wake up fresh, still famous, only halfway through a hard storm. Still Clifford, still full of wild gifts, at rest and in the city of Chicago.
I'm not surprised that you love jazz, because, I mean, it's like poetry, isn't it? Setting the notes on edge, the unexpected, the spontaneous. I think of you in that light. Well, sort of like André Breton and let me see, who do I think of you? André Breton, Miles Davis, and the Beatles. That's who you are.
That's a pretty good crowd to be associated with. Can I get that on the back of my next book?
a t-shirt is in order. But why would you like to write about more musicians?
Well, I do write about musicians quite a lot. Part of it is that I'm interested also, and I think you know this, Grace, I'm interested also in collaboration. And with jazz especially, it's this collaborative spirit of creation that makes the music happen. Each part of the band, say, will get their solo, but together they make the song.
And there are some little guitars
like that for me.
Are there guitars in the back? Do I see guitars in your room?
Yes, there are guitars back here. Yeah.
So you indulge on every level. You're just an indulger.
I do my best.
Yes.
But for me, yeah, that's not my day job, but something I really enjoy.
Well, please take us now to another form.
Okay. Another form.
And tell us why the sonnet matters.
Okay, well, I'm going to read a poem called Sonnet, and then I'll tell you about how the sonnet works differently for me than, say, the prose poem. And this sonnet has an epigraph from Catherine of Siena, and it's simply, "You are that which is not." The stork is gone. Here is the nest. It teeters on the station tower, like a satellite dish encircled in grass or tiny bits of hair, over and over, or yarn around a pair of unseen hands. Old transmissions have come to a hush. The air is static whirl. The road wends. I wonder at this gat, this bulrush basket, mouth in waiting for its tooth. The stork was here. Here is the nest. Praise the giving way, the taking wing. Praise the singing bowl after the song. Praise who cast from such delicate bronze an absence.
The cool thing is we wouldn't know it was a sonnet to hear it.
Well, in a way, that's a big compliment to me. I don't want the music to be center stage in any poem, but I do want it to be the controlling force. I want it to be, you know, the conductor of the train somewhere else, but without that conductor, the train's going nowhere.
That is so true about you. And you don't have us, we're not lockstep. Uh-oh, here comes that syllable. You know, that's just as smooth as liquid gold.
Well, it's Petrarchan too, so the rhyme scheme is more delicate.
Tell the difference.
With a Petrarchan sonnet, it's the rhyme scheme. It's 14 lines, and there are two quatrains, but then there are two tercets at the end. Mm-hmm. And those tercets go EFG, EFG, and they're rhymes. So those rhymes are two lines apart, and it's just enough distance to feel the echo of that familiarity without it imposing, like I say, center stage, its presence.
Such a slight thing that matters. How different from the Shakespearean sonnet?
Well, a Shakespearean sonnet, I think by its nature, is like the scientific method. It's very forceful in its music and in its rhetoric. It comes forward and it says, I have something to tell you, and I'm going to prove it here with support. And here's more support. And here's more support. And here is my conclusion. And the Petrarchan sonnet is not about that, really. It's not about forcefully proving anything, at least traditionally. It's more about delight. It's about the delight of the music meeting the content. And of course, writers have played with those broad generalizations so much that they mean nothing anymore. But to me, that's what it is. And you know, of course, Rilke wrote many of his poems in Petrarchan form. I'm a huge follower and fan of Rilke and his music. The great one, of course, is Archaic Torso of Apollo.
Well, I've never heard the comparison done quite like that. Now I know why the students are lined up around the block at American University hoping to peek in the window because they couldn't get in. But this is from The Long Answer.
Yes.
And now you look at, it's a parade of poems. So you look at your parades chronologically, and what do you make of it?
Of the
parade of poems from the early
days of my career.
You look at the long ribbon of sounds and you say, what have I done?
Well, one thing that pleased me was that I could extract poems from my first book that I was still proud of and which still spoke in some way to poems in my most recent book. That there was a conversation that was going on all along, so of course this is my hand that's creating that illusion of continuousness. But at the same time, if there was none there, then I would not have been able to present it. But I do think that. That there are certain things that I've returned to again and again that I've tried to do in different ways to keep it interesting. And so this book is a representation of that. And it also features the work of my very good friend, Jim Youngerman, the artist who did this.
Magnificent.
Yeah.
Magnificent. How does that define the book?
Well, this is part of a triptych. In fact, I like the fact that the third part of the triptych is missing, that there is a third part that we don't see. It's like the Holy Spirit. it's over here, invisible, but it affecting everything. But there is a loneliness to this, and there are the long shadows that are related to the title, The Long Answer. So that I love the long shadows. I love the togetherness of these houses, separate but together. Here on the landscape, like the body, this is a kind of couple out here. And then these chairs, are emanations of the two.
Oh, those chairs.
The chairs are wonderful.
Speak of everything. And then you've got this crispness and clarity, and then the flow of the water,
right,
which is counterbalancing. So you saw, now that you've seen your life before you in 300 pages, was it a little different to see seeing the whole of it? Was that a little different for you? I mean, did you have any revelation?
I think that the revelation that I've had, even only in the last couple of years, and again, I'm riffing because you're asking such good questions that I haven't asked even myself, but the revelation that I've had has to do with the line that came out of Sonnet, praise the singing bowl after the song, that there is in each of us an inevitable absence that is in us and all around us and soon will become
full,
whole thing, the whole aspect of who we are. This is all impermanent. This disappears. What's left is what we can call, for lack of a better term, that absence, that the anticipation of the song ending, and so this turn towards praising is something that has emerged in the poems in the last few years. Mm. It's not something I've done on purpose. It's just something that has begun to arise from them, which I appreciate. You know, it's the sense that in that poem Truce, God and the devil stop the film and they call their truce, and then the film continues and it's like letting out a breath. But I'm really focused on that moment that the film stops, that moment that is the eternal, that we can focus in on, in objects, in interpersonal relationships, in nature, in history, in theology or philosophy. I'm really drawn to those ideas and observations that have to do with emptiness, that have to do with this absence that is within us and which is the eternal thing.
It is clearly a path that you are on, and it is true to me that absence is fullness. Absence will be fullness, and that is the mystery that you keep trying to unveil. And right now the praising of it is one part of the process. But before we go to a final poem, we have to mention your translations, because you're just fearless. I mean, you went to Czechoslovakia without being able to speak Czech. You live there using just gesturing. You've given all over the world. You just immerse yourself to find out who you are by virtue of not knowing who you are. It's just an incredible thing. So here you have a German that you translated and a Dane. But I want to just mention that Nielsen, he and you are absolutely twins.
Yeah. We.
How did you find brothers. Your brother, your sensibility, the tone, the mystery? Just say a word about him.
Well, as much as he's been my brother, he's also been my teacher. This is the jazz combo effect that I'm talking about. You can't help it. When you translate, as Mark Strand said, to translate is to read deeply. And so you're reading deeply this other, and all the while the seeds of their imagination are being planted in you. So I'm in conversation with him. And in fact, when I write my prose poems, the person that I think of reading them is Karsten. And we've been friends now for 22 years, 23 years. And we're going to do more work together, hopefully, if we're able to travel next summer. He is an amazing, amazing poet, an amazing force in European poetry. Even though he's not widely known, those who love his work and who know it well see him at the forefront of, you know, the imagination.
But he, unlike Wagner, which is your German person, he's not exactly the same. He's not like you, the way Nielsen,
right,
like you.
So and Wagner writes in form. So that's the other part of my alter ego.
Oh.
He writes very musical poems in German and has won the equivalent of, you know, the German National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize, the Büchner Prize. He's a major voice in Germany. And I read his poems, and I feel the same sensibility as Nielsen. In fact, it was Karsten who introduced me to Jan. But we are very different, and so it's more of an effort. I also feel like something is being cracked open there and doubled, as it were, in the doing of that work. I'm learning at a very high rate whenever I work on his poems, because he's doing things that I myself don't do.
You're not afraid of work. You're not afraid of work.
No, I mean, it doesn't feel like work to me. It still doesn't.
No, it's your life force. It's your life force. And now we will have a final poem by David Keplinger.
So I have a new book that's coming out in 2023. And it will be published by Milkweed, and the title is yet to be finalized. But right now, it's a word that comes from a modern translation of a 14th century manuscript called The Cloud of Unknowing. And in The Cloud of Unknowing, this monk is trying to describe what he calls the everlastingness of God. And he says that in that everlastingness, the only word that can describe it is. So the book is called Everlastingness. This is a poem from it. It's called Reading Emily Dickinson in Amherst, Massachusetts. I know how it feels to live in a small leaden room with only snakes and birds as constellation. I know how to imagine death by falling through stories of floorboards, like a poem flutters through molecules, air, and time. It never lands in the yard. The trick is not to die while dreaming of death. That's why the circle of doors and windows here remain open a little. That's why the poems seem always to end on slant rhymes and dashes. That's why the hawthorn cone is never quite in full bloom, but almost. I too come here respectfully. I bow halfway at thresholds. I know how to wait at a completely empty window, holding out my hands.
The trick is not to die while dreaming of death. The voice of David Kiplinger. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Steinippet Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.